Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about the latest on how to live a longer life, slow down those aging telomeres. Then we're going to deal with commentaries. I put off having a guest today because I have so many different topics I want to share other individuals' ideas about. For example, a generation of idiots, smartphones, and dumb people. Who says that? A millennial about his own generation, not that it's a negative, as you will see, it's simply trying to clear up what is real and what is not real. Then I felt it's time for someone who really can put our absurdities, our extremes, our self-righteous indignations into proper perspective. George Carlin. And I was sent euphemisms. So you're going to hear about George Carlin euphemisms. Then our biggest misconception about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Ask the average American, they're unaware of what's going on. Ask your legislator, members of the House or Senate or the White House, 100% they're behind Israel. Well, then how can there be peace if everyone's always on one side? Makes the assumption clear and present that the Palestinians either A, do not deserve to have a peaceful outcome, B, should be taken off the land that historically we are told belongs to Israel, and three, whatever happens to them, including their children, they deserved it. You see what happens when you look at the other as not sacred. So I'm going to do something else today. I'm going to share a commentary from a person who looks at life from a more spiritual perspective. And this is from M.M. Owen, from Eon, about I and thou. And you're going to hear about the work of one person. You may be familiar with him. His name is Martin Buber, B-U-B-E-R. He was one of the people who escaped back in 1938 at age 60. He left Germany for Jerusalem in a professorship at Hebrew University. And he began to look into the area of Jewish intellectual, historical history, rabbinic scholarship, and he came up with an idea. And it triggered a spiritual crisis. And we're going to benefit from that today. And boy, would it benefit everyone in Israel if they took a look at his writings. Now, he's been gone a long time, but that doesn't mean his writings have aged. They've only become more important. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin with the University of Birmingham, as well as King's College London. They're saying that a lifetime of regular exercise slows down aging. I've just finished a new television special. You'll see it on television in probably the summer or the fall at the latest. And it's all about how we age at the cellular level, but also there are no development, growing new neurons. We were told that it's not possible. For decades and decades, we were told that whatever cells you have in your brain, by the time your brain is fully developed, nothing changes. You only get less of them. Absolutely obsolete concepts. We now know that you grow new neurons, new brain cells. So what they have found is this. They have found that if you keep active every day, the body becomes younger and healthier. That's correct. And the researchers set out to assess the health of older adults who had exercised most of their adult lives to see if this could slow down the aging process. And they had some amateur cyclists. They were from 55 to 79, and they found that it definitely made a difference. Now, these people would exercise for 100K a week, and that was about 6.5 hours a week, a little over an hour a day, and it made a tremendous difference. Their blood pressure was lower, their lean body muscle mass, their overall vigor, vitality, stamina, muscle mass, all of these were improved by daily exercise. So let's get off the couches, get up from the desk, and start doing some more exercise. Have you ever noticed that when you're around people who are in their dramas or crisis, or just have a highly, how should I put this, hyperkinetic personality, they just don't seem to be able to slow down, keep their focus, and be mindful. If you start a conversation, they interject. They won't let you finish, like Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly, or to a great degree, Tucker Carlson. I believe that he's done some extremely important work, and I commend him for that. I challenge him on other issues, but he had Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on, and Kennedy said there were only two shows that had him on. I was one. Tucker Carlson was the other, to talk about mercury and vaccines and what the actual science shows. I didn't see anyone else in liberal media having him on. And he's not afraid. Also, consider this. Most people do not engage in debate. More often than not, they just have these sycophants on who align themselves ideologically, politically, or economically with the host. You see this on some programs, you know, all the time. Rachel Maddow used to be with Keith Olbermann. I knew exactly who he was going to have on, what they would say. There was nothing new and vital because no one was willing to accept that they were wrong on any issue. They just kept doubling down. And then not to let someone talk, it's just rude. Secondly, it's bad media because then you can't get a handle on anything if everyone's yelling at the same time. Let someone talk. Even if they're saying something that is patently wrong, let them say it. The audience will pick up on it, and then you can deconstruct it. But unfortunately, it doesn't happen. And as you watch these programs, they're highly agitating. And you get off, you're stressed. You get off a lot of conversations, you're stressed. So here is the University of Calgary. They did a study, and they found that your stress, meaning the person that is stressed, is it changing someone else's brain that they're talking with or living with or sharing something with? Because how do you feel after you spend some time with someone who is always hyper or negative or angry or rageful or jealous or envious? How do you feel? If you're like most people, you feel drained. Here's something new. In this new study, published in Nature Neuroscience, a major peer-reviewed journal, a group of scientists from the Cummings School of Medicine and the Brain Institute, the University of Calgary, have discovered that stress transmitted from others can change the brain in the same way as real stress does. Wow. What does it mean? Quote from the study, brain changes associated with stress underpin many mental illnesses, including post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders, and depression. And this is what they're saying in this. The brain's research team studied the effects of stress in pairs, and so what it means is if you're around people, and let's say you're not stressed, you're just being you, you're okay, but you're around people who are stressed, your brain, not theirs, your brain responds as if it's the center of that stress. And hence, both of you now are being adversely affected. You have a right to tell people, I'm not into your stress. I'll share what I can, if you're interested, of how to deal with a problem, and I'll focus upon the solution. please stop emotionalizing as if because you cry or yell or scream or demean, somehow it's real. Frequently, it is how the brain interprets disempowerment when people don't go along with them, or something happens out of their control, or something happens they don't like. It could be something legitimate. Then again, it could be something exaggerated in their own mind. But either way, you are now a victim of that. Your brain is changing because someone else went bonkers around you. So just remember that. Vitamin D can help prevent heart failure after a heart attack. This is from the Westmead Institute Medical Research. The team at the Institute found that vitamin D prevents excessive scarring and thickening of the heart tissue following a heart attack, which can help reduce the risk of heart failure. So that's very important. Quote, the benefits of vitamin D are becoming increasingly known. And in this case, how vitamin D protects the heart after a heart attack was what they found, and it does. One more reason to make sure you're getting about, I would say, 3,000 units of vitamin D a day. But if you've had a heart attack, you're going to need more. The enemy within. Gut bacteria drive autoimmune disease. This is from Yale University. I'll give you a little primer on this. Bacteria found in the small intestines can travel to other organs and trigger an autoimmune response, according to this study. And the researchers also found that the autoimmune reaction can be suppressed with an antibiotic or vaccine designed to target the bacteria. That's dangerous. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Science. They're looking for new approaches to treating chronic autoimmune conditions like systemic lupus and autoimmune liver disease. So in lay language, it comes down to this. You either have good bacteria or bad bacteria in your gut. Good bacteria don't turn on the autoimmune response. Bad bacteria do. Good bacteria help you synthesize nutrients, including B12, and help to maintain a healthy dialogue between the bacteria in your gut and in other parts of the body. Bad bacteria have an unhealthy conversation. So the idea that when you eat or drink anything that creates a bad bacteria, and we know what it is, sugar, artificial sweeteners, animal proteins, refined carbohydrates, there's your pretzels, pizzas, bread, then you are creating bad bacteria. Alcohol also, and then antibiotics wipe out the good bacteria. And much of the bad bacteria, then the bad bacteria is able to recolonize more bad bacteria. So one more scientific study, and we have had so many, showing that you are your bacteria directly what you eat and drink. And Georgia State University did a study showing that exposure to psychological stress in any form of social conflict alters your gut bacteria. That means that when you have that feeling that in my gut feelings, it's real. The gut communicates those feelings that you're having to the brain, and we didn't know this happened. We didn't know that your gut could communicate with the brain. We knew the brain could send out signals to every part of your body. Chemical signals, electric signals, but we didn't know it worked in reverse, and we didn't know that having a bad experience in your gut then can send, like stress, can send these negative signals throughout the body. One more reason to realize that stress can alter your gut bacteria, and it alters your immune system, it alters your health. So anybody walking around not dealing appropriately with their stress is going to die sooner. What if we just had a clock, a very lightweight clock that everybody wore like a hat, and everybody could see it. And on it, it told you how much time you're quicker you're dying because you're not dealing with your stress. So you walk up to someone and you look, and right there on their forehead, it shows that they're going to live 3 years, 27 days, and 16 minutes. They're going to die sooner than they otherwise would because they're not dealing with their stress. Then suddenly we pay a lot of attention because it's so apparent, so obvious. You literally can work yourself to death. You can stress yourself to death. We now can actually mark how stress in your life affects your heart. It does. Affects your immune system, absolutely. It affects your neurological system and affects your brain. We have all the thousands and thousands of studies. It's not even open for debate anymore because that science has been proven. What we want to know now is what can we do to reverse that? This was published in Behavioral Brain Research Journal. So the gut microbes, your gut bacteria, have multiple interreactions. If you're feeling happy or sad, positive or negative, something to think about. Also, one more thing dealing with gut bacteria from Rutgers University, fiber-fermenting bacteria, there's your good plant-based bacteria, improve the health of type 2 diabetes patients. And this is published in the peer-reviewed journal Science. So what they're saying in this study, which was a six-year study, they're proving once again that eating more of high-quality fiber foods, there's your plant-based diet, will then be better for you if you're diabetic. So if you're diabetic or pre-diabetic, that's 100 million Americans, about 27% of the American population, get on a good, healthy, plant-based diet, get good bacteria, and it helps you. The grains, legumes, nuts, pulses, nut butters, nuts, these are all good for you because the short-chain fatty acids are the ones that produce this gut bacteria. And so, something to think about. And finally, there's a lot of people who binge watch television, binge watch on the computers. I couldn't believe how much time people spent watching porn. There are thousands and thousands of porn sites. They just took one site and it had, I think, 68 million visits every 24 hours. Whoa. Tells us a lot about what people are not fulfilled with in their life and how much time they're wasting. Anyhow, according to the research from Imperial College London as well as Oxford University, binge watching anything can increase your bowel cancer risk. This is published in the British Medical Journal Cancer. And it's one of the largest studies to date investigating the link between a sedentary behavior and bowel cancer risk. So they looked at 500,000 men and women and found those who spent the most time in front of TVs or computers are the ones who are going to be more likely to develop bowel cancer. Something to think about. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. We have a lot of people listening every day. I have about 9 different topics I'm going to talk about, plus some audio clips to play for you. Next one coming up is going to be George Carlin. Then I'm going to open up our phone for talkback on any of the issues that we discussed. Please feel free to call in today and make your comments or ask your questions. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. But I was just given a notice here that Jesse from New York in our studio, Progressive Radio Network, is in studio. Hi, Jesse. What's up?
Hi, Gary. How are you? All right. So We got a new report from Zeno Radio, and that's our phone service that we use for the podcast by phone, the Listen Live. And before I give these numbers, I just want to say these numbers are from word of mouth. They're from you, the listener. You know, we don't have a big promotions team. We don't really promote at all, honestly. So this is all thanks to you, the listener, sharing the word of the Progressive Radio Network. Now, the Progressive Radio Network is in the top three of U.S. stations listened over the phone. And now, the Gary Null Show is number one in the world by phone downloads. So, Gary, you give that number out every single day, and people are listening. Now, your show has more downloads than Alex Jones, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, all of these other hosts. You're number one.
Good. Well, that's nice. I haven't given that number out in a couple of weeks. I better get back to giving it out again. And there are what? There are between 10 to 11,000 stations.
Yes.
That we're competing against. And some stations have like 166 hosts. So just do the math and you see the competition. And it's nice to know, because in the year 2000, I vowed I would not do any more public relations or media. And so we virtually do zero. We don't have a publicist. We don't advertise ourselves. It's just word of mouth. And thank you all for sharing. And this makes I knew that we were rated number one progressive radio program in the world, number one progressive radio station in the world. But that's nice to know that we beat out all those people, because a lot of those people need to have some competition, because they have some very fascistic and radicalized, inhumane philosophies they share. Thank you, Jesse.
No problem, Gary.
Appreciate it. Now, let's go to hear what George Carlin has to say about euphemisms.
With every generation, for some reason, it just keeps getting worse. I'll give you an example of that. There's a condition in combat, most people know about it. It's when a fighting person's nervous system has been stressed to its absolute peak and maximum, can't take any more input. The nervous system has either snapped or is about to snap. In the First World War, that condition was called shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language. Two syllables. Shell shock. Almost sounds like the guns themselves. That was 70 years ago. Then a whole generation went by, and the Second World War came along, and the very same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now. Takes a little longer to say. Doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue. Then we had the war in Korea, 1950. Madison Avenue was riding high by that time. And the very same combat condition was called operational exhaustion. Hey, we're up to eight syllables now. And the humanity has been squeezed completely out of the phrase. It's totally sterile now. Operational exhaustion. Sounds like something that might happen to your car. Then, of course, came the war in Vietnam, which has only been over for about 16 or 17 years. And thanks to the lies and deceit surrounding that war, I guess it's no surprise that the very same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. Still eight syllables, but we've added a hyphen. And the pain is completely buried under jargon. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll bet you, if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time. I'll bet you that. But it didn't happen. And one of the reasons is because we were using that soft language, that language that takes the life out of life. And it is a function of time. It does keep getting worse. I'll give you another example. Sometime during my life, toilet paper became bathroom tissue. I wasn't notified of this. No one asked me if I agreed with it. It just happened. Toilet paper became bathroom tissue. Sneakers became running shoes. False teeth became dental appliances. Medicine became medication. Information became directory assistance. The dump became the landfill. car crashes became automobile accidents. Partly cloudy became partly sunny. Motels became motor lodges. House trailers became mobile homes. Used cars became previously owned transportation. Room service became guest room dining. And constipation became occasional irregularity. When I was a little kid, if I got sick, they wanted me to go to the hospital and see the doctor. Now they want me to go to a health maintenance organization or a wellness center to consult a healthcare delivery professional. Poor people used to live in slums. Now the economically disadvantaged occupy substandard housing in the inner cities. And they're broke. They're broke. They don't have a negative cash flow position. Broke. Because a lot of them were fired. You know, fired. Management wanted to curtail redundancies in the human resources area. So many people are no longer viable members of the workforce. Smug, greedy, well-fed white people have invented a language to conceal their sins. It's as simple as that. The CIA doesn't kill anybody anymore. They neutralize people. Or they depopulate the area. The government doesn't lie and engages in disinformation. The Pentagon actually measures nuclear radiation in something they call sunshine units. Israeli murderers are called commandos. Arab commandos are called terrorists. Contra killers are called freedom fighters. Well, if crime fighters fight crime and firefighters fight fire, what do freedom fighters fight? They never mention that part of it to us, do they? Never mention that part of it. And some of this stuff is just silly. We all know that. Like on the airlines, they say they want a pre-board. Well, what the hell is pre-board? What does that mean? To get on before you get on? They say they're going to pre-board those passengers in need of special assistance. Cripples! Simple, honest, direct language. There's no shame attached to the word cripple that I can find in any dictionary. No shame attached to it. In fact, it's a word used in Bible translations. Jesus healed the cripples. Doesn't take seven words to describe that condition. But we don't have any cripples in this country anymore. We have the physically challenged. Is that a grotesque enough evasion for you? How about differently abled? I've heard them call that differently abled. You can't even call these people handicapped anymore. They'll say, we're not handicapped, we're handicapable. These poor people have been by the system into believing that if you change the name of the condition, somehow you'll change the condition. Well, hey, cousin, doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. We have no more deaf people in this country. Hearing impaired. No one's blind anymore. Partially sighted or visually impaired. We have no more stupid people. Everybody has a learning disorder. Or he's minimally exceptional. How would you like to be told that about your child? He's minimally exceptional. Oh, thank God for that. Psychologists actually have started calling ugly people those with severe appearance deficits. It's getting so bad that any day now I expect to hear a rape victim referred to as an unwilling sperm recipient. And we have no more old people in this country. No more old people. We shipped them all away and we brought in these senior citizens. Isn't that a typically American 20th century phrase? Bloodless, lifeless, no pulse in one of them, a senior citizen. But I've accepted that one. I've come to terms with it. I know it's here to stay. We'll never get rid of it. That's what they're going to be called, so I'll relax on that. But the one I do resist, the one I keep resisting, is when they look at an old guy and they'll say, look at him, Dan, he's 90 years young. Imagine the fear of aging that reveals. To not even be able to use the word old to describe someone, to have to use an antonym. And fear of aging is natural, it's universal, isn't it? We all have that. No one wants to get old, no one wants to die, but we do. So we ourselves. I started pulling myself when I got to my 40s. Soon as I was in my 40s, I'd look in the mirror and I'd say, well, I guess I'm getting older. Older sounds a little better than old, doesn't it? Sounds like it might even last a little longer. Shit, I'm getting old. And it's okay, because thanks to our fear of death in this country, I won't have to die. I'll pass away. Or I'll expire like a magazine subscription. If it happens in the hospital, they'll call it a terminal episode. The insurance company will refer to it as negative patient care outcome. And if it's the result of malpractice, they'll say it was a therapeutic misadventure. I'm telling you, some of this language makes me want to vomit. Well, maybe not vomit. Makes me want to engage in an involuntary personal protein spill.
Yep, we need to remind ourselves of how absurd we are at times. And George is the person to do that. Now we're going to something more serious. This is not being covered by any of the media. It's just not, and it's not going to. This is not going to change. This is about looking inside of Israel, talking with Israelis and Palestinians to see what is going on, why is the conflict continuing, and most importantly, is there a way of resolving it? Of course, there's a resolve in every problem, but you have to have people who want that outcome. And therein is the rub on many sides. This is Abby Martin.
So you went to Palestine. What would you say is the biggest, most common misconception people have in regards to the Israeli-Palestine conflict?
That they're not, it's not an equal fight, and it's not a conflict that just fuels each other. There's one side that's colonized and the other side that's colonizers, one side that's oppressed and the other side that's the oppressors. It's a land that was a colonial settlement project, openly ethnically cleansing people. It's pretty much the most obvious example of settler colonialism that's still going on, and ethnic cleansing. And they've just been given carte blanche under the Trump administration, because you see bills now being presented in the Israeli and the Knesset that want to annex the entire rest of the West Bank. Another big myth that we hear is that a two-state solution is possible, and that's what we need. When you look at how the West Bank and Gaza and Jerusalem, which are the three territories of Palestine, how they're all laid out, there is no state to be had, because you can't just conjoin these three random things over like this giant map and be like, okay, this is your state. Gaza is an open air prison where they send, you know, people to die and starve. It's all controlled by Israel. There's 90% unpotable water. The West Bank is a territory that is all littered with illegal settlements. So you go to these Arab villages in the West Bank, and there's just a settlement on top of an Arab village. Like, you have to be really insane to move across the world and want to move right on top of an Arab village when there's like hundreds of miles of empty arid land in the rest of Israel proper. So two big myths is the two-state solution. Really what there needs to be is one state with just equal rights. You know, that just is the only thing that can happen. And just the whole equal fight. I mean, Palestinians cannot own firearms. They're under military law. Like, they are literally under martial law in the West Bank. They can't even hold a flag. They can't be a member of a political party. If you're in a congregation of 10 people, that's like illegal, because it means that you're like part of an organization or a protest. So all of these things, imagine being under like martial law, where you're just policed all the time. You have to go through these crazy checkpoints. You're harassed, you're dehumanized. If you're found with something that can be construed as a weapon, you can go to jail for 10 years. People who post things on Facebook, the amount of likes and shares that a Facebook post can get, if you post a photo of someone who died, you can go to prison for the amount of like days of the likes and shares of the Facebook post. So there are so many horrible things, not to mention there was just 500 kids arrested. Like, I just saw a report of how many kids are tortured and arrested. So people, you know, Israel's whole survival is based on projecting what it does to Palestine onto themselves. So they claim that they need this giant security apparatus in order to be safe. That's not true at all. They are illegally occupying an entire swath of territory, and they are policing and brutalizing an entire population on a daily basis. And it is not an equal fight. And we just hear, I mean, the first thing I remember after 9/11 was seeing that propaganda footage of Palestinians dancing in the street. And I also remember hearing that Palestine did it. So what does that kind of propaganda do? You know, like, just planting the seeds and just this indoctrination. I didn't even know what Palestine was until I was 18 years old. So I think that we're just so indoctrinated and brainwashed with the one side of the narrative. We don't really know the truth, and we don't know how bad it is. Man, it is really, really bad, and it's way worse than I thought until I went and saw how crazy it is. There's just like, there's this place called Hebron that is the most visual representation of apartheid I can fathom. I mean, it's just people are just in cages. Like, Palestinians live there. It's become a ghost town. Israeli settlers have come on top of them and put cages where they just throw like diapers and alcohol, and just like they just treat them like animals because that's honestly what they are. I also went and talked to Israelis. I talked to hundreds of Palestinians. I also went and talked to a lot of Israelis in Jerusalem in a place called Tolerance Square. And I was talking to them. I said, what do you think about the situation? Like, very general questions. And about 90% of them said openly genocidal things like, let's carpet bomb them, let's exterminate them. So I think that a lot of people don't realize kind of the fascistic tendencies of Israelis and the settler colonial mindset. It's not a very peaceful society, and it's not necessarily like a democratic society like it paints itself to be. So they want to claim that these settlers are really extreme and they're an aberration. That's not true at all. It's the same kind of sentiments inside Israel than you would see, you know, out in the settlements. So, but it's disturbing.
There isn't a big do we run the risk of making the mistake of that Israelis are the Likud party, just like the Americans aren't the Republican party, right?
Sure.
There's a lot of people who push back against the wars and push back against stuff. Isn't there a lot of people inside Israel who push back against the apartheid state?
So there are a lot of people, and this is a thing that you'll see also, is a lot of people, left is a slur. There are a lot of liberal Zionists, who kind of paint the language of human rights and the two-state solution. And yes, they are pushing back. They hate Netanyahu. They hate the fascistic takeover of the country. But they still, at the end of the day, think that the occupation is like
moral?
Moral, in a way. Like, they want a more humane occupation.
Okay.
But a lot of leftists have fled. My friend Ronnie Barkin, who is an Israeli anti-Zionist, says that, you know, leftists are getting harder and harder to come by there because there's only so much you can take in a society that's becoming increasingly fascist. I think that Israel started off a lot more communistic. It was a lot more of like these kibbutz type people who were like socialist minded. And now it's become a very different project. And I mean, it's just, and it doesn't even matter really what Israelis think at the end of the day, because what needs to happen is restoring basic human rights and ending the apartheid state. So okay. Whether or not they do it within, I mean, they're not doing it within Israelis.
We're not going to see an end to this until we have leaders, both Palestinian leaders and Jewish leaders, as well as supporting leaders within the Arab communities that realize that peace has to be universal, cannot be one-sided. Everyone must benefit, and we have to start now. We can't go back and use old arguments. And with that, I want to share something from M.M. Owen of Eon. And it's about someone that, if you're into some of the literature of the Jewish mind, one of the most important people, there was George Alexander Pick and Ernest Cohen and Mark Bloch and Walter Benjamin, yes. But there was also Martin Buber. And Buber was born back in Vienna in the 1870s, and he was a very well-known and respected Jewish intellectual. His grandfather had been a rabbinic scholar, and the family tree stretched back through centuries of noted Jewish figures. And like many people, especially those who think independently but also respect the community they're in, he went through a spiritual crisis, and it was triggered by his perception of what he called the edginess of space and the infinite loneliness of time. And I'm sure all of us, I'm sure everyone listening has had that moment where wherever you're at, you just realized how vast the universe is and how insignificant you are in that. Not even one grain of sand on the ocean floor. This came to me first when I was down in Texas and I was doing a run one evening, a mile down from the old Healing Springs Ranch, which thousands of you had visited, and I came to Lake Ray Roberts, and I would turn around and come back. And it was very bucolic. There were pastures with horses and cows and sheep and goats, and no one was ever on the road. Because my property was about 200 acres down that road, and I took almost all of it on one side, and then there were some other farms. So it was my chance after a long day just to relax, unwind, and put everything in perspective. And this happens so many times. You look up and you hear the big sky. Now, you can get the big sky in Montana and Wyoming and Utah, but you really get it in Texas, where there's just vastness. And you see all the stars, and then you realize, wow, someone in time, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, may have been in this place looking up and seeing the same heavens. And why am I here? What is the significance of this moment? What is my significance? Do I have a significance? That, to me, represents what Buber said was the edginess. The idea of an infinite loneliness, that's better stated. And so he went on, and he went to the University of Vienna and Leipzig and Berlin, and his interests moved from art towards religious mysticism, and he rediscovered the writings of Baal Shem Tov, a founder of Hasidism. And by the way, Hasidism, I'm sure we have a lot of Hasidim listening right now. It's a Jewish sect. It's more interested in subjective numinicity than external ritual. And he was overwhelmed by what he called the Hasidic soul. And over the next few years, he published Yiddish Hasidic folktales. He was very popular. He was like a cult, had a cult following in Germany. But then he decided to go deeper into this, and he was a preeminent believer in Zionism, and the soon-to-be successful movement to establish a Jewish homeland on that patch of earth, which in the Torah it is claimed that God promised to the descendants of Abraham. Well, that's one of the contentions and one of the reasons it's being fought over to this day. Anyhow, it was during World War I that he wrote a very important work, probably his most famous work, and I'll spell it for you, I-C-H-U-N-D-D-U. That means, in English, I and thou. And he first came to his concept in 1916, but he didn't publish I and Thou until 1922. It's a little book. You can read the whole thing in under an hour. But boy, is it powerful, because it takes you on flights of heartfelt lyricism that channel Buber's encounter with Hasidic soul. And what it means is this. Not so dissimilar than, let's say, Marcus Aurelius' aphorisms, or Michael de Montaigne's essays, or Albert Camus' take on Sisyphus myth. The same literary quality is often what causes the book to be dismissed by academic philosophers of being too loose or unsystematic or overly subjective. But look at it this, and here's my takeaway message. What he was saying in I and Thou, human existence is fundamentally interpersonal. Human beings are not isolated. We're not free-floating objects, but subjects existing in perpetual, multiple, shifting relationships with other people and the world, and ultimately, he believed, in God. Now, life is defined by these myriad interactions, and by the push and pull of inner subjectivity. This conception ties Buber's belief in the primacy of the spoken word. And one of his great projects was, in fact, I believe it was like a 37-year process of producing an idiosyncratic German translation of the Bible. And he believed the I and the thou argues that within this elementally networked reality, there are two basic modes of existence, I and thou. Now, the two stances make up our basic twofold attitude. In the I mode, you're dealing with ego, and hence you're going to approach another human being as an object separate from yourself. And this type of engagement is driven by a sort of instrumentalism. The object is engaged primarily as something to be known or used, and its nature is always mediated through the subject's own self-regard. So from the I stance, we don't engage in things in their entirety. Instead, we engage with a web of distinct and isolated qualities notable for how they are useful to us. Think of slavery. Think of the slave owner. If I kill a slave, they won't do the work I need. And before mechanization, they had to have manual labor. So the slave has a value only to what it is able to produce. It is the it. There is no soul. There is nothing sacred. If there was, you wouldn't have slavery. You couldn't. You cannot objectify and hence use as a form of commerce something that is sacred. You cannot kill people. You cannot throw drones into a village square. You cannot look at someone across a battlefield and say, you have no soul. You do not have a representation within my consciousness that shows that I should save you. Hence, I'm going to kill you. It comes down to that. The person selling you something you don't need, selling you something that is of no real value to you, something that will cost you, something that will indebt you, and frequently enslave you to that debt. Who could do this? Well, how about all the banks and payday lenders and even our federal government with student loans? It's around us everywhere. So I think Buber's concept of looking at what we become, the I, which is ego, and we engage in this isolated quality of what you represent, same way sexually, the objectification. And he considered this kind of self-centered outlook typified in the view of proto-existentialists as Nietzsche. And by contrast, the thou relationship, rather than simply experiencing another, we encounter them. Now, think of the difference between experiencing someone and encountering them. A subject encounters a fellow subject's whole being, and that being is not filtered through our mediated consciousness with its litter of preconceptions and projections. No purpose intervenes. According to Buber, the thou stance has a purity and an intimacy and an inherently reciprocal energy exchange. In relation to others, he argued, we can step into an inner subjective space where two people coexist and co-contribute to what he called the between. In this between lurks the vital, nourishing experience of human life, the real sacred stuff of existence. All living is meeting. And at the highest level, he and the Hasidims and others from other beliefs and cultures that share similar values and views, like the Sikhs and the Jain society, certainly. Jains are almost never discussed. I don't have time to today, but I'll get into great depth of the Jains' belief, one of the most pure living spiritual groups ever. But they believe that God represents the eternal thou, the only entity with which we can maintain a permanent between. In any other meeting, there is a constant vacillation. Even our own treasured thou occasionally regresses into the it or the I, even if we only do so for a few moments. So there's always the capacity to be our opposite. This is sometimes confusing when I tell people that you're never healthy, you're never happy, you're never brilliant, you're never creative. You're in a process of doing that. So each day when you awaken, by saying to yourself and then committing your interdisciplinary skills to it, today I will do everything possible to honor being healthier, happier, more creative, more spiritual, giving to others. It's a process. Therefore, we never stop and think of ourselves as unique, and therefore the ego comes in because of what we've done. Okay, you did something. It's like a chef. I don't want to go into a restaurant, you know, and I've owned several very successful restaurants, vegan restaurants. I don't want to go into a restaurant where someone throws down some sloppy food on a plate and on the table and says, that's it. And I'm looking at it and say, well, look, the presentation's not good. I don't see a unique use of display design. And when I take a bite, there's no real unique taste to it. And the person says, no, you're right. But I did that yesterday. But today's today. Well, I get a break, don't I? Do you get a break from being moral, ethical? Do you get a break from being healthy? This is our mindset. This is what Arthur Koestler said, nothing is more sad than a death of an illusion. We live with these illusions, we're compounded with illusions, that somehow we're something we're not, and then we honor what we're not instead of what we could and ideally should be. So if people in the Middle East want to have peace in all areas, then we got to stop listening to the John Boltons as if they're the great sages because he was lucky enough to become an ambassador and uses that as his moniker to get on every show, including last night. He is the last person in the world who knows anything about peace, nor anyone over at Fox. These are all, you know, these are all harping seals. They don't know how to do scholarship. They do not touch that deeper element of spiritual awareness. They're not capable of it. Go back to a great rabbinic scholar, a Hasidim, who believed in Israel, but believed in seeing the sacred. What if the Jew and the Arab dealt with each other as thous instead of I's? Therefore, you would not be able to kill each other, hate each other, loathe each other with such extreme passions. If you put love at the same capacity as hate that I see in the Middle East, there will be immediate peace and forgiveness and understanding. And I'm going to take some calls for the last few minutes of our program. If you'd like to call in, share your thoughts on my thoughts and the ones I've shared from others, please do so. 888-874-4888. And I'm seeing that we just got an email. Let me open it up here. Okay. This is from Peter. Peter, hello. Today, Gary was talking about a study, Your Stress is Now My Stress. In the past, I've heard him talk about taking care of aging parents, which I do. But my parent has a lot of stress because of not liking their situation, and they all have cognitive issues from two strokes. So how does a person take care of a parent in such situations? I can't and certainly wouldn't tell them to get out, but I can tell you I definitely feel the results on me of their stress. So basically, is there a way I can protect myself from their stress while still caring for them and providing a home for them? Absolutely, yes, you can. But you have to understand just three simple principles, Peter. First, do not engage in irrational beliefs, but rather rational behavior. What do I mean? Rational behavior is that you're a caregiver. Hence, you've got to separate out in your mind that you're the son and that you're a caregiver there to help these people on the final stage of the journey through this life. By doing that, then, as the Buddha would suggest, you're not completely tying in all of your feelings to the success or the outcome, because the outcome is not going to be one that anyone's going to like, but is one that's going to be realistic. And that leads to number two. Try to separate out your fear of loss, which precipitates irrational emotions and behavior, and That way, you can look at your parents and say, these are people that I love. They brought me into this world. They nurtured me. They cared for me. They gave to me. So I'm going to educate myself as to what I can do now for them to make their journey to wherever life takes them after this space. I'm going to make it as positive as I can. But it's how you approach it. If you approach it with the need for an outcome that is not going to be realistic, then you have lost the conscious value of the true meaning of what's going to happen to them. And hence there's this every day of the fear. Will they be alive today? Will they recognize me today? And you can't deal with that. You have to deal with the idea that they need my help. I'm going to empower them with my help and not disempower my own emotions. And I'm going to value this exchange. This exchange will be important for both of us. That would be my suggestion. You might also take a look at the documentary I did. It's up on YouTube. It's called Overcoming the Dark Side and Happiness. Those two would help you. I'm looking at the clock. Wow. Let me see if I can squeeze. No, I don't. My engineer said, out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. And Sunday night, I have a webinar on sexual healing. It's 2.5 hours long. You can go to GaryNall.com or PRN.FM. If you'd like to join me, I'll be taking calls. I'll be taking your, not calls, but I'll be taking your questions or statements. And I approach it from a different perspective. I approach it with the idea that how to heal from traumas, how to understand what you truly are, how to share what you are and your needs with other people, and things that can help us stop objectifying others and look at them with a different mindset. It'll be a really upbeat and positive experience. It's called Sexual Healing. It'll be Sunday night, starting at 6:30 p.m., and it'll be a webinar. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
You must be a special lady.
You'll be singing first, single,
no, Harry, I'm singing second, man.
And a very exciting girl.
I'll bring that bass out, man.
Hey, man, I'll bring it out a little bit more.
You gotta be a special lady.
Let's get down on some harmony, come on.
Cause you got me sitting on top of the world. Sitting on top of the world.
Somehow I knew it would be you to change my gray skies to blue.